Mr. O'Donnell?
Chair, thank you very much. We've heard from counsel to the inquiry in opening to this case study that the Anglican Church provided the inquiry with a list of 390 church personnel who've been convicted of sexual offending against children in the past. The information that was also provided shows that until December 2018, of the 231 claims issued, 122 of them involved abuse by clerics, 86 by non-clerics, including church volunteers, and 36 of the alleged perpetrators had more than one claimant make an allegation against them. So it seems perfectly plain that the Anglican Church has an ongoing problem with child abuse. Now, we know church abusers often have access to all aspects of the life of a child. We've heard in this and other case studies that they, you know, often are held in high esteem, hold positions of real power. That's the culture of the Anglican Church. It's a family, and that family continues to protect its own, we say. A4 gave evidence about the abuse perpetrated by F15 and then the response he faced when he disclosed this to the church. He told various church leaders repeatedly from the 1970s until 2012, including the Bishop of Hereford, the Bishop of Salisbury, the Bishop of Durham, the then Bishop, Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, and he said that the church response to his numerous disclosures was effectively to ignore them, and then, as he put it, to totally blank the issue of secondary abuse within the church, that being a reference to the secondary abuse he felt being ignored. A88's evidence was moving. She was sexually abused by Victor Whitsey. She learned at her mother's funeral that her brother had suffered similar abuse by Whitsey. The fact that an Anglican vicar, Elaine Chegwin Hall, overheard them talking about that is less important than the fact that it took Miss Chegwin Hall over 15 months thereafter to report what she'd heard to the police. A88 told the panel that if mandatory reporting had been in place, her brother, whom she said had passed away a year after their discussion, would have died knowing that the sexual abuse inflicted upon him had been disclosed to the proper authorities. No satisfactory reason was given for that 15-month delay. In her statement, Ms. Chegwin Hall described what she overheard as being, quote, odd, rather than a safeguarding concern. Despite A88 giving entirely clear evidence to the panel that her brother's words were, "That bastard abused me." If hearing that type of phrase doesn't constitute a safeguarding concern, then we wonder what does. Reverend Matthew Innerson gave compelling evidence of the church response to his disclosures of being repeatedly raped by an Anglican vicar as a child. He told the Bishop of Doncaster in July 2012, the Bishop of Sheffield in December 2012 and February 2013, and then Bishop Martin Snow. He then told Bishop Stephen Croft, the Bishop of Beverley, and the Archbishop of York in 2013. Yet his evidence was very clear that nothing happened until the police took action a few years later. What makes the church's response even more shameful in his case is that it left Reverend Innocent's abuser free to continue potentially to abuse for 5 years after his original complaint in 2012. We say all of this is clear evidence of the church continuing to cover allegations up and refusing to engage with survivors in the modern era. But what's the Anglican Church's official safeguarding policy? Well, in our opening, Mr. Scorer quoted Mandate Now and their description of the Anglican Church's safeguarding policy as a thicket of inconsistent discretionary guidance, which carries with it the risk of confusion, mistake, and non-compliance. Well, we say the fact that this thicket of inconsistent guidance is discretionary is the real problem. Ian Elliott, from whom you heard evidence, who'd worked in child safeguarding for 45 years, described how A4's case was handled. He said initially he was impressed by the enlightened policies of the Anglican Church, but he described, quotes, a very clear difference between what the policy stated and what the practice was on the ground. He said that whether or not official church policy was followed, quotes, seemed to be a matter which was entirely up to them. There wasn't anyone within the church that actually would hold them to account in any way against the stated policies. And if the church does acknowledge a complaint, how does it act upon it? Well, safeguarding advisor for York Diocese, Julie O'Hara, gave evidence. She described the difficulties she faced in dealing with a reverend of the church, X7, in relation to X7's treatment of one of his parish church group leaders, ciphered as F71, who'd been convicted of indecent assault in 1997. Further allegations against F71 were raised in 2011, 14 years later, by A143, but despite those further allegations, by 2017, F71 had been promoted to membership of the parochial church council. Early last year, Miss O'Hara said she told X7 that F71 needed to step down. She said Reverend X7 was upset by this, and he responded by telling her he felt quite strongly that the abuser, F71, had changed and the decisions that they were making were unfair. Well, then Reverend X7 gave his evidence. First, he admitted that when he spoke with A143, who'd come to him with those further allegations in 2011, well, he told him he needed to learn to forgive himself, principally, and learn about the principle of forgiveness more generally. He didn't offer any pastoral support, saying he wasn't aware that he should have offered it. He didn't consult his safeguarding advisor, because he wasn't aware of the existence of a safeguarding advisor. He said he was unaware of the House of Bishops' guidance, and that when he heard A143's further allegations against F71 in 2011, he, quotes, never thought of going to the police. He said he'd never heard of risk assessments, and he couldn't understand why F71 might need to be risk assessed. This was in September 2017. He also confirmed, in answer to questions put by Miss Sharpling, that he didn't ask about the age of F71's victims. He didn't know who they were, he'd had no contact with them, and he didn't bother to contact the police for any information about them. In summary, we say X7's evidence was entirely consistent with the criticism levelled by survivors at the Anglican Church, that it's still spending more time looking after the perpetrators of crime than it is the victims. And as I say, this example wasn't historic. X7's evidence was in relation to safeguarding concerns that were still ongoing last year. Well, the X7 evidence related to an abuser at parish group level. What about the Anglican Church's formal approach to the investigation and discipline of alleged abusers in higher positions of authority? Well, the panel's heard a lot about the CDM in this wider case study, but we say it's hard to know what disciplinary proceedings are ever actually taken against the clergy because they're not made public. Bishop Alan Wilson put his concerns about clergy discipline characteristically well. He said, I think a lot of CDM proceedings are conducted in a dense cloak of secrecy, so nobody knows what's happened. And therefore, in terms of the church learning from disciplinary lapses by clergy, that can't possibly happen, because nobody knows when anything has gone wrong, what it was. And what if a very senior Anglican is the perpetrator of the alleged sexual abuse? What about the Peter Ball-type cases? Well, again, Alan Wilson put it well when he said that the church, quotes, cannot expect somebody who's a mid-range employee of the bishop to hold the bishop to account. The Anglican Church has made a number of positive statements throughout these inquiry hearings about cultural change. It all sounds very forward-thinking, but what's actually occurred in practice? The survivors' evidence is essentially that it's still more of the same. Tribalism, smokescreens, no engagement in the type of real cultural change that they say is required to protect children. The questions put by Mr. Frank to Bishop Mark Sowerby at the end of his evidence about the church's progress towards cultural change in the context of a working party set up by the Archbishop's Council in 2014 made the point particularly clear. Bishop Sowerby's answer to Mr. Frank indicated that the Anglican Church might just be trying to run down the clock, might be making all the right noises whilst this inquiry is ongoing, and then getting back to business as usual once these hearings are finished. Wales safeguarding officer Faye Howe put it well. She said, my concern is that some really great things are coming out of ICSA, but once that's finished, it might make the bishops and everyone else quite complacent. Well, we fear she might be right. In her opening address, Counsel to the Inquiry also told the panel that in 2017 there were 1,257 complaints of safeguarding concerns made to the Church of England, of which over 50% related to allegations of sexual abuse. We know from analysis undertaken by the Truth Project that of those individuals who've spoken to it, almost half disclosed abuse contemporaneously to a member of the church clergy or a safeguarding officer. Yet the panel was told that only around one-third of the safeguarding concerns that were disclosed to the church were then referred on to statutory authorities by the church year on year between 2015 and 2017. But well, plainly that proportion is far too small. These are the church's own statistics, but they of course beg the question of what happens to the other two-thirds of the safeguarding concerns that are not referred on by the church. Well, we've said repeatedly to this inquiry that the case for externally enforced mandatory reporting is overwhelming. But what do survivors actually mean when they talk about mandatory reporting? Well, what the Slater and Gordon survivors mean is this. A law that compels those in regulated organisations, here that would mean everyone in the Anglican Church, from the lowliest church officers up to archbishops, to inform as soon as is reasonably possible a safeguarding service, but also external agencies such as the police, whenever they believe a child's been abused or they've been told by a child that he or she may have been abused. The mandatory part, as the panel knows, means any failure to inform is a criminal offence. That, we say, would create a culture of disclosure and make people feel normal when they disclose, rather than feeling that by disclosing allegations they're doing something abnormal. Such a law would give support to those who disclose and stop them feeling, to put it not too fine a point on it, like whistleblowers. It would make it a matter of routine, as Reverend Innocent put it, to pick up the phone and call the police. Well, what about the negatives that are often associated with mandatory reporting? Firstly, it's said that a mandatory reporting law would lead to an increase in reported allegations. Well, of course it would. More reporting is an obvious consequence of making reporting mandatory. It's happened in every country where mandatory reporting has been introduced. And of course a mandatory reporting law would need to be resourced. That goes without saying. Well, secondly, the Charity Commission has given evidence to this investigation that the increase in reports that mandatory reporting might create could divert attention from the most serious cases. Well, we say that's an obviously bad argument, not least because how can anyone possibly know what the most serious cases are if most of them are going unreported, as the Church of England's own statistics indicate seems to be the case now? Well, thirdly, what about unfounded allegations? Well, there'll be more of those as well if there's such a law introduced. But the evidence suggests not many more. Department for Education research indicates that false allegations tended to account for around 2% of all reported allegations after reporting was made mandatory in certain circumstances in schools. It's a very small percentage. Well, fourthly, what about increased costs? Well, more reporting will obviously mean more resources are required to cope with the additional reporting. But it's far from obvious that this will lead to increased cost overall. The extra cost of funding, the extra pressure on existing resources, such as the police and social services departments, has to be set against the cost to society of people suffering childhood sexual abuse. As the Archbishop of Canterbury put it yesterday, childhood sexual abuse can destroy lives. Survivors need support. They often need lifelong support. Many are left entirely incapable of work as a result of their psychological injuries. An increase in allegations being reported as a result of a mandatory reporting law will mean that more abusers are brought to justice. That seems plain. And which in turn will mean less sexual abuse of children. Well, we say that's a reason in and of itself for mandatory reporting, irrespective of the increased costs of funding it. But when one considers the benefit to wider society of fewer people being sexually abused in childhood, the arguments against mandatory reporting, we say, look very weak indeed. And of course, the obvious practical case for mandatory reporting, which was made in evidence by safeguarding consultant Ian Elliott, is that the machinery of child protection is reactive in nature. It can only react to information shared with it, and without information, it's obviously powerless. Alan Wilson made the practical case even more clearly. He said, "It's impossible to protect people without some degree of mandatory reporting, because you never know what happened. You can't do anything about it. It really is, as he put it, as simple as that." When Bishop Wilson was then asked by Ms. Sharpling what the current barrier was to reporting disclosures to statutory authorities right now, he said that he thought it's because people are still anxious that they'll somehow, as he put it, bring shame on the church by reporting one of its members. Well, we say Bishop Wilson is right about this and much else. Change has to be enforced from outside, or more children will continue to be sexually abused within the Anglican Church. And perhaps surprisingly, what's come out of this case study is that the real powers of the Anglican Church have endorsed a mandatory reporting law as well. We've got the Archbishop of York, John Sentamu, giving evidence on oath supporting it, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, endorsing it in his evidence, of course, yesterday. All that's required now is a clear recommendation from this inquiry that it be made into law immediately, unless I can assist further.